Now, French President Emmanuel Macron is in Washington, D.C. this week for an official state visit. He's been meeting with President Trump and will dine at the White House with the President and First Lady tonight. France is one of America's oldest allies, with a relationship dating back to colonial times, and barring some disagreements over the years, they're a key international partner. But there are some significant differences of opinion between the two presidents. One of those differences, the Iran nuclear deal. Macron told reporters today that he'd like to see maybe a new agreement in place to keep the U.S. on board. Trump, standing beside him, reiterated his opposition to the current deal.
We'll see also if I do what some people expect, whether or not it will be possible to do a new deal with solid foundations, because this is a deal with decayed foundations. It's a bad deal. It's a bad structure. It's falling down. Should have never, ever been made.
Garrett Martin is with us now, lecturer at the School of International Service at American University. Garrett, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, before we get into some of the issues on the table between France and the United States, I want to talk about the personal relationship between the two presidents. A lot of people have been making, I think, a pretty big deal. They seem to get along pretty well, despite their differences. How do you characterize their personal relationship and how important it could be for diplomacy?
Well, I think I would agree that it seems that they've been able, despite the appearances or despite the fact that they all have very different backgrounds, a very different age, they seem to have very different views on many important matters, they seem to have been able to build a constructive relationship. As far as we know, they speak to each other very often on the phone, they're in close contact, and the body language seemed, you know, the handshakes notwithstanding, seems to be pretty warm. So they seem to have been able to build a close relationship. And I would say that it does matter greatly. At that level of the high level of diplomacy, being able to have chemistry and affinity can make a big difference in terms of the key dossiers that you're talking about, whether it's Iran, trade, or Syria.
There are big differences between them, but they both, in their respective countries, kind of came out of nowhere in political terms to capture their country's highest office. Do they feel maybe a kinship because of that?
Yes, I think they certainly feel that they are outsiders, not traditional politicians, and you're rightly so, came out of nowhere. I mean, I mentioned that Emmanuel Macron in 2014, 3 years before he becomes president, was unknown to the wider public. So I think that the fact that they've been able to surprise everyone, I think, does create a bit of a kinship. They also, I think, can both share that kind of business background. Emmanuel Macron was a banker before really joining government. So I think they have that sort of in common as well, which helps.
Let's get into some of the possible points of contention. We heard President Trump there talking about the Iran nuclear deal. He's been critical of this thing for, you know, since he was a candidate. France seems to be backing more or less where we are now. Is there room for agreement?
Well, I'm personally a little bit pessimistic. I mean, Donald Trump has been very vocal. If there's been something where a topic where he's been consistently opposed and consistently critical, it's definitely the Iran deal. He was so during the campaign, and he's been since he's been in office. So I interpreted the press conference today as Emmanuel Macron trying to dangle the prospects of a grand bargain, which would address some of the concerns that Donald Trump has put forward about the Iran deal, in particular this issue of the sunset clauses, secondly, Iran's ballistic missile development, and Iran's broader behavior in the region. So I think he's dangling this idea of a grand bargain as a sort of desperate way to try and keep Donald Trump on board, in my view.
Right. The understanding of the Iran nuclear deal was that it was the Iran nuclear deal. By taking all that other stuff you just and other issues off the table, it was possible to arrive at this agreement that otherwise would have been, I think most people thought, impossible to cover all those issues that President Trump is hoping to cover.
Yes, I think that's correct. It was a strategic decision made many, many years ago, because I think we shouldn't forget that the Iran nuclear deal of 2015 was essentially 12 years in the making. I mean, the early diplomatic talks start with the three European countries of the UK, France, and Germany back in 2003. And I think they realized that if they tried to bring in those other subjects, as you mentioned, and including also Iran's human rights record, you would never go anywhere. So they made a very strategic decision to try and limit themselves to those subjects. But now, of course, that became fodder for those who oppose the deal, whether inside the United States, but also other countries in the Middle East.
And staying in the Middle East for a moment, we saw cooperation in the retaliatory or cautionary strike in Syria responding to a major chemical weapons attack. Does that point to the way ahead for maybe cooperation between the U.S. and France on Middle Eastern issues?
I think it's possible because certainly Emmanuel Macron, one of the key threads of his foreign policy has been to try to put France in the center stage and at the heart of complex problems. So I think certainly in Macron, I think Donald Trump will find a willing partner, someone who's willing to get his hands dirty, who's willing to try and tackle these generally insurmountable, intractable problems. I think he's also taking advantage of the fact that the traditional European partner of the United States, the UK, is embroiled with its own Brexit problems, and the chemistry between Donald Trump and Angela Merkel is not good. So in a sense, by default, the French have placed themselves as a key European ally for the United States.
Garrett Martin is with us, lecturer at the School of International Service at American University. He's with us to talk about the relationship between the U.S. and France as French President Emmanuel Macron makes a state visit to Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of Macron's visit? What are your thoughts on the long relationship between the United States and France? Despite differences on things like Iran, climate change, trade, is there room for cooperation? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about French President Emmanuel Macron's state visit to Washington, D.C., his meetings with President Trump. Garrett Martin is with us. He's a lecturer at the School of International Service at American University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching this visit? What are you watching for? What do you think about America's role in the world, in Europe, our relationships with allies in the era of President Donald Trump? Call 800-642-1234, or if you have a question for our guest, 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Garrett, I want to get in a couple more issues that may be points of disagreement between the two. One big one, climate change. The U.S. under President Trump has pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement. President Macron has regretted that decision by the U.S. Is this something you think is going to be talked about on this visit?
I'm sure it's going to be talked about briefly. I mean, it's already was mentioned a little bit in the press conference. It will also be interesting to see if Emmanuel Macron mentions it tomorrow during his joint address in Congress. I'm not sure it's going to be a major subject of discussion for this time around because I also think there's very limited room for convergence. So I'm not anticipating it to be a major topic, and also because it's already a pretty crowded agenda if you think about not only Iran and Syria, but we also haven't mentioned trade and North Korea. So I'm sure it's going to be briefly mentioned, but I don't think it's going to be a central point of discussion either.
Yeah, when I was thinking through what we'd talk about today, I kept coming up with one more. Oh, yeah, and climate change. Oh, yeah, and trade. This is a packed, potentially very packed meeting. Does anything really get accomplished when there isn't that one point of focus?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think it's important in terms of cementing a good working relationship between the two. I think also because although there's urgency right now in some of those topics, for instance, the May 12th deadline for the Iran nuclear deal or the upcoming meeting between Trump and Kim Jong-un, these problems are still likely to have to be resolved in the long run. So I think it's very important that Macron and Trump are able to build a good, solid relationship because that partnership is going to be very much needed down the line to address these very thorny issues that are not going anywhere.
Let's talk about trade. You mentioned that just a moment ago. President Trump has said, reiterated, hey, I like bilateral trade agreements. I'd like to negotiate directly with France. All this Europe stuff, I'm paraphrasing here, is getting in the way, whereas Macron and the French leadership seem to be really on board with sticking with the European idea even after Britain leaves. Is that a sticking point in trade negotiations between the two countries?
Well, I think it's an institutional sticking point because the makeup of the European Union, member states have largely delegated key powers to the European Commission and the European institutions to negotiate on their behalf. So, yes, bilateral agreements would be a problem from that perspective. I think in addition, there's a serious problem from the perspective of the Europeans that they feel that they're being asked to negotiate with a gun to the head. And I think that is not conducive to building trust. I think there's certainly a desire to address any trade problems. I mean, if you think there had been an attempt at negotiating a broad trade agreement under the Obama administration, the so-called TTIP. So I think there's a willingness to discuss trade. There's a willingness even to address any concerns the United States has, but not in that kind of blackmail manner. I don't think that's going to find European leaders, and Macron included, very receptive.
I want to go back to a kind of a big picture issue you touched on earlier. France may be looking to see itself in a leadership role in the world. As some people have said, for better or worse, they see the United States under President Trump retreating from such a strong leadership role in the world. Is this something that President Macron regrets, that the United States might not take active leadership in things like NATO, international trade, things like that? Or is he thinking, okay, fine, this is an opportunity for us?
I think by and large he regrets it, because I think there was in the past a tradition of certain French presidents who wanted to build themselves and build their country in opposition to the United States. But I don't think that's Macron's position. I think Macron is quite pragmatic, and I think he understands that for many of those complex multilateral or global problems, whether it's, you know, as you mentioned, climate change, the future of the Middle East, Syria, or even the future of European security with NATO, these are areas where a U.S. role and a U.S. presence is indispensable. So I think he would, in my view, regret the United States at times backing out or withdrawing on some of those matters.
So what do you see as the role of France as a leader on some of these issues, I guess, whether they want to be or not?
Well, I think the complaint, for instance, if you take on the domain of burden sharing, that Donald Trump is arguing that NATO allies and European allies are not spending enough and are not being serious enough on security, I think Macron and France and other countries can take the lead in showing and clearly communicating to the United States that they are serious about defense, they're serious about security, and they're serious about tackling some of those problems that the United States has been intimately involved with. So I think that's a very important role, to show that Europe is taking into account the concerns of the United States, is proactive, and is serious about addressing those same problems.
We'll leave it there for now, Garrett. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Garrett Martin is a lecturer at the School of International Service at American University. He joined us today to talk about French President Emmanuel Macron's visit to the United States and his talks with President Trump. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Southwest Airlines is compensating passengers on a recent flight in which the engine was ripped apart in midair, forcing an emergency landing in Philadelphia. A woman died on that flight and seven others were injured. The airline canceled dozens of flights the past couple of days so it could inspect its jet engines. It said that all of the engines, similar to the one that failed, would be reviewed over the next month. So what's the takeaway here for air passengers? Plus, where are some great places to travel in the months ahead? Peter Greenberg is the travel editor for CBS News and the producer and co-host of the public television series The Royal Tour. He's also a graduate of UW-Madison. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be with you guys.
Well, before we get to the fun travel stuff, Peter, let's get to some of maybe the scary stuff that might be on people's minds after this Southwest flight, this tragedy. One passenger died. Could have been way worse, it looks like. After a crash like this, what should travelers be thinking about, and what are airlines doing?
Well, first of all, I need to correct you. It was not a crash.
True. Thank you.
It was a very safely executed emergency landing, and we're very thankful for that. Airlines are certified. In fact, aircraft are certified to fly on single engines in situations like this, and that's exactly what they did. So that's the good news. The somewhat troubling news is that, you know, Southwest Airlines flies only one type of equipment, the Boeing 737, with basically one type of engine. So the good news, and also the troubling news, is that they can identify the problems right away, but it also means they got to inspect every single plane and every single engine, which is why you're seeing so many cancellations and disruptions today as Southwest pulls planes from service to perform those inspections.
And you've compared this to an incident, I think it was back in the 80s, with a flight to Hawaii where there was, again, a fatality, but we learned some valuable lessons there.
That was the Aloha Airlines quote-unquote convertible flight. You see, 737 planes are called high-cycle planes. That means multiple takeoffs and landings. They do much more in one day than a Boeing 747 does in its lifetime because they're short-haul planes, or they're shorter-haul planes. And that means you're pressurizing and depressurizing the plane. It's sort of like taking a can of soda pop and filling it and unfilling it. Sooner or later, you may have some metal fatigue. And that's what happened on the Aloha plane back in 1989. The top literally peeled off. And the good news is all the control cables on a 737 are under the floor, so the pilot still had control of the plane miraculously. One person died. That was the flight attendant who was literally sucked out of the plane. They managed to land. But once they inspected that plane, they realized there was a system-wide problem with all 737s that were high cycle because of hairline fractures and cracks in the metal skin, and that needed ultraviolet inspection to determine that and to fix that. They've done that ever since, and we haven't seen that incident repeated. We have the same situation now in terms of inspections with the engines, in terms of fan blade cracks, which leads to a separation, which leads to a disintegration. So they've got to inspect every fan blade of every engine to look for those hairline fractures, and that's what they're doing right now.
Big picture, Peter, we see these stories in the news, an incident like this. Air travel looks scary, at least for a little bit. How do we stack up, though, when it comes to airline safety now compared to, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago?
Well, here's really good news. In the last 2 years, we've celebrated the best safety record in the history of commercial aviation. Up until what just happened last week on Southwest, we haven't had a passenger fatality on a commercially scheduled jet since 2009. And let's put that into some perspective. We're talking 36 million flights a year, and nobody died. Now put that in perspective on I-90 between Chicago and Madison. You'll see the difference. And that's because we've really improved reliability. We've improved cockpit safety in terms of the sterile cockpit and pilot training and systems. Now, the fact that we have an excellent safety record is great. We can't improve on that. Our challenge is, how do we maintain that? And that gets down to maintenance, outsourcing of maintenance, and proper federal oversight of that maintenance, and that's where we're sorely lacking. The FAA does not have enough inspectors, and the protocols of inspecting the outsourced maintenance facilities, otherwise known as MROs, is a little questionable. I'll give you an example. If an FAA inspector wants to go to El Salvador to inspect the maintenance work that they're doing on a lot of U.S. Airlines planes, first of all, he has to get permission from his supervisors, and then he has to give that location a 7-day advance warning that he's coming. That's like the health department giving everybody a week's notice that they're going to inspect the restaurant. Not a good idea.
Let's turn to the fun side of travel now, Peter. You are recommending some great international travel destinations that might not be as expensive as some of the more on-the-beaten-path places we might go. Where are you pointing people toward right now?
Well, we're a very big, beautiful situation right now where the U.S. dollar is still strong against so many foreign currencies. We have a lot of empty seats going over to Europe simply because so few foreigners are coming to the United States right now. The numbers have dropped between 7 and 9%, which is staggering when you look at that economic impact. And the reason for that is mostly because they're perceiving the American country as unwelcoming, inhospitable, or closed. So what would have normally been their return seats home now become our outbound seats there. So you're seeing airfare sales that are not just seasonal anymore, especially overseas. They're all year round. That's the first thing. The second thing is you look for countries that have high standards of living and low cost of living, not to mention lower airfares. One that comes to mind is Portugal. Yes, it's the kingdom of a dead empire. You mentioned Portugal. You ask Portuguese folks, hey, what's going on? They want to talk about Vasco da Gama. But you know what? I forgive them for that. It's a great place to go, such great history. And imagine 5 Michelin-starred restaurants in Lisbon alone. That never would have been the case 5 years ago. And, again, high standard of living, low cost of living. And there are airline deals there as well. For example, if you fly to Lisbon on TAP, that's their airline, they also fly to 68 destinations in Africa and Europe. And they have a deal where they'll fly you to any one of those 68 after you go to Lisbon for free. That's the deal that you get there. Another great deal is Malta. Look at the map. It's only an hour and a half flight from Rome. Talk about history. Every world leader and dictator in the history of the world just about has hung out in Malta, including Napoleon. Great history there. Great food. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Cultural Capital. And, of course, if you're like me and you like olive oil, you go to the island of Gozo in Malta. They've got the best olive oil ever. And remember, you can book on the flight. So in addition to going to Rome, keep going, and you'll end in Malta. Another great destination that stays there for me is Mexico, still affordable for Americans, and places like Puerto Vallarta and Acapulco and Mazatlan and Cabo San Lucas. People forget Mexico's got 4,000 kilometers of coastline. It's a huge country. And then I'll give you the one that's my secret, and I saved it for last, and people don't ever think about it. This is the year for Rwanda. Imagine a country that 24 years ago was devastated by the worst genocide in our history, in our lifetime, where in one 100-day period, 1.2 million people were summarily slaughtered. And from that point, nearly a quarter of a century ago, it's had, in my reporting history, the most remarkable transformation of any country we've ever seen. It's now the leading economy in Africa, the most environmentally responsible, the highest enrollment in primary and secondary schools. They pioneered medical research and transportation systems. 60 Minutes just did a piece on their drones that are transporting medicines to rural areas. They banned all plastic bags. And their economy is growing at 7%. And last but not least, which gets into my wheelhouse, travel and tourism. They've got the mountain gorillas. And what they've done there to be socially responsible and economically responsible is 10% of whatever you pay to go see those gorillas goes right back to the local communities.
Talking to Peter Greenberg, travel editor for CBS News, producer and co-host of the public TV series The Royal Tour. Let's talk a little more about The Royal Tour, Peter. You went to Rwanda. Now, this is an opportunity not everybody's going to have. You got a tour from the president of Rwanda, right?
Right. The concept of the Royal Tour specials, which you've been doing for 17 years, is that I go to a sitting head of state, a king, a president, or a prime minister, and I get them to actually give me 6 days of their schedule unencumbered, free, no controls. I then show up with a crew that's larger than most TV crews. It's about 40. We have 8 helicopters and drone units and dive units and mountain climbing units, bicycle and donkey units, whatever we need. We send the Ministry of Tourism home, and then think Thelma and Louise, but a happier ending. For the next 6 days, that king, president, or prime minister is my personal tour guide to the country for this one-hour special that airs on public television. They have no right of editorial control. They have no right of review. The first time that the head of state sees the show is when we actually premiere it.
That sounds like a lot of fun. And I want to check out a destination closer to home. It was very close to home. I grew up about a half hour from here. You're recommending Detroit.
I am recommending Detroit. It's coming back. You know, it's really coming back in terms of rehabbing all the old buildings and turning them into really productive cultural centers and restaurant scenes. The food scene in Detroit now is exploding. The market scene there is great. Listen, Detroit had nowhere to go but up, and guess what? It's growing up.
I'll throw in a plug. The Detroit Institute of Art has the Diego Rivera mural, this four-wall mural. It is not going to come on a traveling expedition to a museum near you ever. So if people make it to Detroit, that's a must-see. Any other must-see sites there, Peter?
Well, the market scene, especially in the restaurant scene. And when you go through the neighborhoods now, you're going to see old buildings that were abandoned or burned out that have completely been rehabbed. And along with that comes the art gallery scene, the music scene, the food scene, and it becomes a walking city. I love it.
And you wrote in a recent piece for a great travel tip for people. When you go somewhere, you need that local information, hit the local library, you say.
Well, there are two places that I always stop. One you mentioned, the local library, because the people there are, what a surprise, better read. They're the locals. They know where to go. They know where not to go. They're a great resource of information, and people don't remember, don't forget, that, or they don't think about the fact about the accessibility of libraries. I gave a statistic in the piece that I wrote that I'll repeat to you. There are more public libraries in America, if you want to look for location and closeness, than there are McDonald's.
Wow!
So you're always close to one. And the second place for resources that I've always given, and is one that will also surprise most people, is the local firehouse. Because they've literally been in everybody's house, everybody's hotel, everybody's restaurant, everybody's museum. They literally know where to go, and guess what? They know where to eat. I know this for a fact because you may not know this, but since I'm 18, I'm a fireman in New York. I'm active. I'm on duty 3 days a week, 7 months a year. So I'm telling you from experience, unless they're out on a call, You stop at the firehouse, they can't be more helpful. They're the best.
All right, let's wrap this up on a public radio note, Peter. Why travel?
Oh, that's the easiest one. We're not singing Kumbaya. Travel is the best instrument and tool to build bridges and to basically find common ground. Most Americans don't have a passport, which is truly disturbing. Only 37% of us do. But if you're listening to this program and you've got a passport, then use it. You know, it's good for 10 years, costs about $165. That's $16 a year. What a great investment. It gives you options to go anywhere. And with the exception of maybe four places in the world, I'm going everywhere.
Peter, thank you so much.
You got it.
Peter Greenberg is the travel editor for CBS News and the producer and co-host of the public television series The Royal Tour. He's also a graduate of UW-Madison. We talked with him about great places to travel in 2018.